Oh, I didn't start my watch. Let me get that. Now, Julian Pelletier. Do it one more time. I won't forget.
Julian Pelletier.
Pelletier.
Yeah.
Pelletier.
Well, I'm saying it the way you said. The right name is, the right pronunciation is Julian Pelletier.
Pelletier.
That sounds a bit strange, eh?
Pelletier.
Right.
Pelletier. Now, you'll probably have to, I'm an old man, and you'll probably have to tell me that. But I'll remember your first.
I'm an older man.
I'll remember Julian. I will remember that, I guarantee.
Julian. Try to retain Julian.
We'll just call you Julian today, okay? And where are you physically right now?
I'm physically right now in Montreal, Quebec, Canada.
Montreal. Quebec, Canada, in your home, and you alluded to your age, sir. So how old are you?
Well, I was born, I know you're pretty fast at doing this. I was born May the 7th, 1935.
1935, so you're 69, right?
Right.
69.
You got it.
Well, that's 69. I'm looking forward to it. It's coming up. I'm 60, how old am I? 64, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you knew that already, though, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
You listened to
I heard you. Mentioned it a few times.
You listened to our little old shows, haven't you? Well, it seems like that you were doing very well for your age. Was that your wife that answered the phone?
Yes. Yes, it was. And by the way, my wife doesn't speak English.
I was going to say, the language in your home is French.
Yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, about 99% of the time I'm speaking French.
Is that right?
Yeah. When I was born, I was in a French-speaking slum of Montreal. Very bad slum, and what is important in my case is to retain or to note that up until I was 18, I did not go to school, and I did not know a word of English.
You did not go to school, and you did not know one word of English.
What I mean is, I might have known yes and no. I think I did.
But that would be about it.
Yeah.
Well,
that's the thing to remember, to retain, while we try to talk about my life.
Now, a poor slum in Montreal,
and
they spoke French there, and everyone around you spoke French, and no one spoke English,
And about 99% of the people around me didn't know English.
And you were born totally blind?
Well, just about. I mean, I had the light perception. I could see a few things.
Uh-huh.
I could read, you know, the big print on those cornflake boxes and stove boxes. And that's about it.
But you could read that big print.
Yes, but what hurt me is my dad always said that I was just short-sighted, you know, and all the people thought that I had much more sight than I did. And of course, boys came in the house and they said, "How many fingers?" You know, and to get out of it, I'd say, "You always got five," you know.
Yeah, but your dad couldn't admit the fact that his son, his boy, couldn't see.
Because he didn't think that a blind person could live, could make a living.
Well, he'd never been around any that were successful, so he would have no way of knowing. I guess you can't blame him, but then a lot of parents don't think that, I couldn't have a blind child. This couldn't happen to me, not me, as macho as I am, you know.
Especially, of course. What he used to tell people I know, and he shouldn't have said that around me when I was a child, is that, well, you know, we do our thing, it's just the mother that has to do the vest within the next 9 months. So he blamed the mother.
Oh, yeah, blamed his mother. Oh, yeah, yeah. But this was 1935, and we weren't at an educational level then. We didn't have the news then. We didn't have the TV then we've got now. So you started out in this slum. I guess that was pretty tough. You remember a lot about being a youngster?
Oh, yeah, I remember a lot of it because, you see, we were the worst of the worst because of the personal psycho-emotional problems of my parents. See, my father was an alcoholic. He was a compulsive gambler, and he was the what they call today a character neurosis. He was fighting all the time. He was fighting everyone. He was never happy. Didn't like anyone. And he was moving on. No stable. You know, every time my mother would go into the hospital for because she was bipolar.
Yeah.
That is, we called today bipolar. Now, a few days back, we said depressive. You know.
Yeah.
He was depressive.
She was manic depressive, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nowadays we call it bipolar because sometimes they can get high. You know, they can have some highs.
Yeah.
But sometimes my mother would cry days and days on end, you know, and I was pretty insecure as a blind child, you know. And I had a sister, but my sister didn't live what I lived because she was looked upon as a good child of the family, my personal family and the extended family. And I was the bad child. And the good child cannot do wrong, no matter how hard he tries. Uh-huh. And the bad child cannot do good, no matter how hard.
No matter what they do. So your mother would cry for several days, and then she would be just jubilant for several days.
Yeah, but then she was suicidal in those times.
Oh,
she was crying,
man.
And then she was taken to the hospital. And then whenever she was taken in, well, my father would sell the furniture, and we start all over again.
So he would get drunk and sell the furniture to buy alcohol.
Yeah.
And so the cycle started again.
Yes, yes. And that's why I remember today when I was thinking about your call, I remember Christmas when I was about five. And my father and I, because many times I found myself alone with him because my sister was somebody else with some families.
And your mother was crying.
My mother was in the hospital.
Yeah.
Because, by the way, nobody would take me in the family because they said he's blind, so we can't take him.
So we don't want him, yeah.
So
no.
I had to stay with my father. And then that Christmas, the Christmas Eve, my father said, I'm going for a beer. You know, I'll be right back. And then he came back just Boxing Day, you see. So I spent the whole Christmas in that burnt-out store alone.
But he didn't come back until the next day.
Yeah, he didn't even come back at Christmas time. He came back the next day. And, you know, I was hearing the people walking by, children. Everyone seemed to be happy, and I was alone in there, and I was thinking, what am I doing here? You know, and I was very sad. You know,
it is sad. It's terrible. I mean, there are kids worse off than you, but that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
That's pretty bad,
and
my boy.
It's hard to take for a blind child because you're defenseless. You can't do anything, you know.
You're there.
I couldn't go out. I didn't know where to go, you know.
Yeah. That's and that would be traumatic. I mean, that would scar you emotionally. There's no question about it. Okay, so you were with your father. Now, there came a time at age six when the rest of the kids went off to school. What did they do with you?
Phil, it's like that you asked the question. My father said, I've never been to school, and I'm doing well in life. Well, he wasn't doing so well, by the way.
Wasn't doing worth a damn.
Hey?
He thought he didn't know that.
No, he didn't know that. So he said, you won't go to school because, well, why would a blind guy go to school for? What use is that? So what his idea? One of his ideas was to have me raise chickens. So when I was about eight, he bought about 25 chickens.
Wait a minute. To have a blind person raise chickens?
Yeah. Yeah. He thought that that'd be my livelihood.
That's the weirdest thing I've ever heard. Good heavens. That's nuts. Crazy. Crazy.
I know. Well, everybody thought he was crazy, by the way.
Well, he was. Obviously, he was. And so he bought these chickens. What happened?
Well, you see, we were right in the heart of Montreal, a city of a million people. So about a week after this, the neighbors, what do you think they thought? They called the police.
You can't have chickens in the middle of Montreal.
And then that was I ended my career as a chicken handler.
That was it for
right then and there.
How old were you when he tried this little experiment?
About eight.
We're going to let Julian raise chickens. And,
yeah.
And so the last couple of weeks, they called the police and made you get rid of them.
Yeah.
So what did you do all day? They wouldn't send you to school.
Oh, my goodness. You know, Phil, my childhood and teenage years is being lonesome, being nothing to do. I was alone in my backyard, and my sister, all summer, she went to my aunts or my cousins or in the country. See, many people went in the country in the summer cottages, and they said, we can't take him, he's blind, you know what I mean? So I stayed alone in my yard, and I didn't do anything, and I was lonesome.
And I guess this was in the 1940s.
About that, yeah.
And so there wasn't the system there is nowadays. Some neighbor would report him for doing that.
No.
And authorities would come and take you to the blind school.
Yes, as a matter of fact, years later, I worked for WC, so I know, for Youth Protection. It's really funny.
You worked for Youth Protection.
It's paradoxical,
amazing.
You see. I worked
yeah.
for them.
So it is.
There was no system like that.
Nothing like that. So you were just alone by yourself.
And there was no compulsory schooling or attending school.
No.
I mean, and there was no law for that in Quebec. So, you didn't really have to go to school if you didn't want to. You know, so, well, you see.
Yeah. And you couldn't see enough to get around, so you were just at the house alone by yourself.
No, I couldn't see enough to get around. No.
Did they fed you?
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, but my dad was the longest time he kept a job was about a month. So many a time we were on welfare or, you know, me and my sister, we had to go and beg because he many a time, you see, we didn't have a home. So, my father was a janitor for a private school for the girls in the secondary school.
Uh-huh.
And those girls were very rich girls, you know, that went there.
Yeah.
So, he parked me in the front of the school when the girls come out, and he asked me to beg, but I didn't beg. I didn't even have to. They took pity on me. Now they all gave me some money, you see?
Yeah.
You know, they said, what are you doing here? I said, yeah, well, my father is a janitor. So I heard some of the girls say, oh, yeah, that's the crazy guy that we saw around that, you know, yesterday. This is what I heard about him.
I bet that didn't last long, did it?
No, about a month.
Yeah, so he'd get a job, and then he'd get drunk and lose the job.
And then he worked at night in the in a bakery, and I slept there a few nights. The guys came up and woke me up and gave me some donuts. Everyone took pity on me. You know, they didn't know what to think about that. You know?
Yeah, it's all funny now, but it's tragic. I mean, it's all, you know, you've done obviously well, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But this is, that's just very sad. It's almost medieval, you know.
But you see, I try not to think about that, but, you know, I know today that I have to think about it a little bit.
Well, I don't want to bring up any bad memories, but I think this is, it's good for...
Oh, I slept in a stable.
Yeah.
I slept in a very rich man's house. One day, my father said, we don't have any place to sleep, so go. I'll stand in the corner and go to that door, and you know that guy that was rich, and I come up, and about 6 or 7, I said, sir... I don't have any place to sleep. And he said, well, come in. And then my dad come up then. He said, oh, yeah, you're not alone. I thought you were alone. And then we slept in his basement that night, and we had bear skins, you know, to sleep on.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the most marvelous night because it was warm, you know.
Yeah.
And because my father, many of the time, he left me out of the beer parlor, you see. And you see, we're not in Texas, you know, in Montreal, you know. It fell, and in the winter it gets pretty cold. And I felt cold. I felt very cold. Sometimes I felt so cold that I was sleepy. And when you're sleepy, when you're cold,
yeah, you're fixing
it means
to die.
That you're pretty cold.
That means that you're hypothermia. You could die. You could go to sleep and die.
You're getting there. You see,
that's right.
But mind you, what I'm telling you now, I didn't know at the time. You see, I just thought about it way many
well, you were just a, you were just a kid.
But
you didn't,
I didn't
know,
understand.
You didn't understand. That's right.
And I couldn't understand. And I couldn't understand that I couldn't trust my parents to support me in anything. You see, I mean, I knew that from very, very early, but that made just me sad, you see.
Now, he would leave you out front. He would go in the beer parlor and drink.
You see, here's the thing, Phil, that I could never understand, is that in the summer, he'd say, I'd go and have a beer to cool myself. In the winter, he'd say, hey, I got to have a beer to warm myself. And I never could figure out how the same thing
Yeah.
Would warm you and cool you at the same time.
It was a conundrum.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it remained a mystery to me at that time. You know?
You know, I let me say one thing. You have the nicest laugh, the way of talking and laughing as you talk. You just I don't know you. I've never met you, but I would think that you'd be a pleasant person to have a nice cold beer with.
Oh, yeah, of course. Of course. I wouldn't deny one. You know
what I mean? I'm sure you wouldn't. So he'd leave you outside, and you were cold and hungry, and it was just a bad...
And I remember one day one woman come out and say, you know, I was like a poor child. I mean, you know, anyone took... She said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm waiting for my dad. What? You know, she was. She said, kind of bum is that? You know what I mean? And then she said, where you live? Where'd you live? I said, I told her my address. I knew it at the time, even though we'd been there only a couple of months. And then she took me to my place. And she started, you know, giving it to my mother. Then my mother started crying and crying. And then the woman left and saying, what can I do?
Really? Yeah. There's nothing you could do.
Yeah.
All right, I'll tell you what. Let's take a break, and we want to come to the first time you realized I've got to do something, or I'm going to be, and I'm never going to. Because there had to come an epiphany. You had to go, okay, I've had enough. I'm leaving. I'm doing something.
Yeah.
Back in just a minute with more of our little show called Blind Like Me.
We'll record our 100th Blind Handyman Show, and you're invited to the celebration. We'll begin Friday, November 5th at the Sheraton on JFK Boulevard. Saturday, we'll have special motivational speakers and panel discussions on blindness issues.
Then it's Saturday night, and on to live music and karaoke.
Sunday morning, we'll record our 100th Blind Handyman Show.
And we've got something special planned for Sunday afternoon.
Then it's Sunday night, and time for more live music and karaoke.
All in all, a great weekend to meet old friends and make new ones.
For more information, call 936-634-9500 or email philparr@txucom.net. Reservations and meeting room space are limited. It's first come, first serve.
Join us in Houston, Texas this November, and we'll guarantee you a weekend you'll not soon forget.
936-634-9500.
Julian Pelletier is here with us from, he's in Quebec, Canada right now, and from his home, and had a very bad childhood. Father was an alcoholic. Mother was what they call bipolar or manic depressive.
Manic depressive.
Manic depressive. I've been around some of them. I thought I was one time. But anyway, their drugs will treat that, but a manic depressive left alone can cause a lot of problems in the family. My heavens.
An electric shock.
Oh, my. So at some point in time, at some age, you must have decided, I got to do something. What happened?
But I tell you, I got to tell you a few things before that.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
Sure.
When I was about 10, there was this friend of mine. I had just one friend. And this friend I had because I didn't know at the time, but I knew, and this was later on, that he had epileptic fits, epileptic seizures.
Seizures,
and
yeah.
He didn't go to school. So, you know. A guy that didn't go to school, you know, there weren't too many around, you know.
Yeah.
Apart from me, he was the only one. And he used to, what he did is, he'd take a run at me, you know, a friendly run, and he'd jump in the air and fall on my shoulders, you see.
Really?
When I was sitting down on my balcony.
Uh-huh.
And one day I got up, not meaning badly, and he fell on his head.
Oh, my.
And he hurt himself, not too badly, no fracture or anything, but, you know, it bled a lot.
Oh, my.
But everyone said that I was crazy, I was insane, I was mad. And then, you know, they took a petition to send me in the insane asylum.
Oh,
because I was
heavens.
Looked upon, you know, a guy that is blind and who, doesn't do anything. You know, people looked at it a bit suspiciously, and even in our part of the woods, you see.
Yes.
And it didn't work. Finally, they dropped it.
But they were going to send you, not only were you cold and hungry, but they were going to send you to an insane asylum where you'd be around mental patients all the time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the only good thing about that is they might have fed you and kept you warm.
Yeah. You're right. Some people even said you don't have bed and room. You know what I mean? You know, you'll have bed and food.
At least he'll be away from these crazy parents of his.
Yeah.
But they didn't do it. But
well,
this,
it didn't. It, well, I don't know what happened finally. You know, my parents, my dad fought around and he hired a lawyer and he didn't pay him and the lawyer sued him. Oh, my goodness. And then we moved from there. When we moved, we'd moved not far. We could move about three doors because... You see, just to see my father, he was. One day, the owner came in and he said, "Look, sir, you're paying $12 a month for this this shack, you know?
Yeah.
Now I'm raising the thing. I'm raising it to $13. And my father, you know, I won't take that outrageous race. I'm gone. You know what I mean? Just imagine today, eh?
Oh, yeah.
And then, what happened is, there are many other things that happened, but it happened, the thing happened when I was 16.
Okay.
When I was 16, my mother had another psychotic episode.
Uh-huh.
He went in, and my father sold everything, and he disappeared.
He just left.
We couldn't find him. So my relative said, "Look, we'll take you in, but not for long, you know. You're blind, and we don't want to be bothered with you.
Yeah.
And then they got an idea. Send me in. You know, confine me. Put me away in an insane asylum. Because, you see, they couldn't see what I could do otherwise. You know, I didn't know anything. I was 16. I was blind.
Had never been to school. Didn't know Braille. Didn't know anything.
Yeah, no. So
didn't know English. Didn't know anything.
See, in those days, it wasn't so far-fetched in this way that they had done it from their grandfather.
Yeah.
The grandfather, it bothered them. So you, in those days, you paid a psychiatrist. He signed you up in room and board for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Well, when I overheard them saying that, you know. So I was doing something myself. I was looking for school.
Yeah.
But everyone was telling me that at 16, too bad, too late. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
Until I hit upon what we call in Quebec a notary. It's a lawyer that deals with real estate.
Uh-huh.
We call it a notary in Quebec. And this guy said, "What? Look, I believe in you. You don't seem to me to be too stupid,
insane, or anything."
He said, "I'm going to try to get you somebody to pay for you because I had heard of this school in Brantford, Ontario. This school in Brantford, Ontario, dealt with people." Blind people in Ontario and the West.
Okay.
Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta.
All right.
And I asked them to write out to them, and they wrote back and they said, "We'll take them." But
right away they said they'd take you.
Yeah. It's $500 a week, $500 a year.
Oh.
No money. I never had $5 in my pocket.
Yeah.
The time. So he said, "I'm going to find you a guy that'll pay for it." The guy said, "I want to be anonymous, but he has to succeed. If he doesn't succeed, well, I'll stop paying, you know.
Yes,
I'll
sir.
Pay for the first year."
Okay.
And and then that's it.
So you went to the school for the blind.
When I got there, Phil, I knew just one thing.
Uh-huh.
That I didn't know anything.
You knew
that
you,
I knew.
You knew you were aware that you didn't know anything.
I knew I was ignorant. And then the first day I was there.
I love it. I love it.
The first day I was there, they asked me my name, of course. And I said, I tried to say it, you know what I mean? First of all, I didn't understand. So they got me some guys that were learning friends.
Oh, wait a minute. These folks were speaking English.
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't know any English?
No. So they got a guy that was learning friends.
A translator,
In the 11th year, grade 12th year, you know what I mean? And this guy said, "What's your name?" I said, in French. Can you both know? I said, "Julius, don't you?" And then we were all in line to go to breakfast, you see.
Uh-huh.
Everyone heard Julius. So they laughed out. They laughed and they laughed and they said, "Julius Caesar."
Julius Caesar.
And from then on, Phil, I swear, they never called me Julian.
You were Julius Caesar from then on.
Yeah, for good.
Yeah, for good. But at least if this place was not cold and they were fixing to feed you.
Yeah.
It was a warm place, and we were much better off here.
But then, that was the language, at least. And that was you see, I want to apologize. If anyone that was there at the time is listening, I want to apologize and say that I never told them, and they never knew that I knew nothing when I got there.
Yeah.
So, you see, they asked me things in French. Say, the people that were learning French, they come up to me, how do you say that? So one girl one day called me about 2 months after I was there, and she said, hey, Julius, just always, you remember.
Yeah, Julius. Yeah.
Would you say grease monkey in French? I said, what? And in myself, I said, what's a grease monkey? I thought it meant, she meant a fat or fatty monkey.
Little fat monkey, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I didn't know. I said, I don't know what you mean. I said, you know these guys that work in garages, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I said, I gave her a name. I said anything.
Yeah.
Then she said that in school. And then the French teacher came up to me and said, look, I don't want you to be stupid with my students now. Come on now. Don't tell them all anything and anything about French. You know? If you want to make jokes, don't do it.
Yeah.
But I still didn't say anything. You know, she thought I knew French, of course. I could speak. But I had no academic knowledge.
All you knew was how to talk, how to ask for food.
And then some other guys make jokes. You know, sometimes in class we had to tell jokes. And this guy come up to me and says, you'll say this joke. What did the record player say to the record?
Uh-huh.
I didn't understand. He said, it said, flip me over and give me a piece. And when I said that in class, everyone burst out laughing, and the teacher said, why do you swear? Why are you so vulgar, Julian, you know?
Yeah.
And I still didn't know that. I didn't want to tell her.
You didn't understand. You just didn't. You really didn't understand.
No.
You were trying to. Were they trying to? Was there some? Were they trying to teach you English or what?
Pardon me? Oh yeah. I have to say that I don't know why, but they put me in grade 7.
They put you in the 7th grade
when I got there.
Well, yeah.
And this other guy, we had to write a composition, you know what I mean? And this guy said, you know, you know an old lady around your place in Montreal? Now, I've been there a few months, and I started to know something, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, in your composition, you just say, when you meet her, I met the old hag down the street.
Yeah.
And I said, I wrote that. And then she got down on me. And then the guy, what do you mean? And so he started laughing away. And she said, Earl, come up here. And she said, you did that to Julian.
You told Julius to do this.
And
yes.
First of all, he denied it, but then, you know what I mean? And the second year I was there, oh, yeah, when I come back at the first year for Christmas time, my extended family really got on me. They said, why do you want to do that? Now, are you finished school? You know, my sister had the right to go 12 years in school, and me 3 months, that was too much.
Yeah.
And one of my aunts said, you got a one-track mind. She said, you want to go to school. What will school do you? You're blind. Well, what will school do to you? You're blind.
How will it do you any good?
Yeah, it won't do any good. You might as well stay here. And then she had her idea. Send me over to the insane asylum, you see.
Okay, but this friend of yours that had gotten you into school first.
Yeah.
He took you back, or he made you saw that you got to go back to school?
Oh, yeah. Well, the first year I passed. Passed. You know what I mean?
You
I
passed.
I was a billion, but I passed.
You actually passed.
Year,
and by then you had learned some English.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
By the time I got there the second year, I was very surprised that I learned quite a bit. And then one of the guys in my class said, you know something, Julian, or Julius? At the end of the year, you're going to be first of a class.
You're going to be first in your class.
I said, you're laughing. You're making fun of me. Come on. Don't play tricks on me.
Yeah.
And he was right.
And so you graduated. You were first in your class at the
Absolutely
end of that year.
Absolutely first for the rest of the time that I've been there. I wasn't there.
Well, okay, but by then you weren't the new kid anymore. You knew some English, and so good things started to happen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you were in the top of the class from then on.
Yeah. But I was surprised. I surprised myself.
Well?
Because everyone told me that it was too late to learn, you know, in Montreal.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it.
Well. People thought different then. It was times were different, and you know.
So I couldn't even. And over there, you know, you had gym, you had the shop, you had the piano tuning, all sort of things that I didn't even know it existed. You see.
Did they start teaching you Braille?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I took Braille, and I had the Perkins. We had the Perkins Braille right away.
All right. And so you learned to write Braille, and you.
And I learned the manual typewriter. You know, I was not the best at it because I know there was a couple of girls in the class that was. You know, they had taken piano for many years. I think that's why they were very fast, and I couldn't keep up with them. You know, on the typewriter. And the teacher, you know, she kept, come on, go faster. And I couldn't, you know, couldn't do it. And just at the end, when it was over, I was just getting to them. But, you know, it was a bit late.
Well, but you did fine. I mean, you did all right for a kid who had never gone to school and never done anything, you know.
And listen to this. At the end of when I left Brantford, well, the superintendent called me, and he said, what are you going to be doing now? And I said, well, I'd like to go on to college, you know. And he said, you know, I got a guy here that wants to finance you.
Now, this was when you graduated, when you got ready to leave the school. So we're up now to about 1953, right? 54?
Oh, later on, 57, about that.
57. So
And I got this guy. And he said, I want to tell you something. I want you to thank your family. Because without their support, you couldn't have done it. And he still didn't know that I didn't know anything when I got there.
You didn't have a family.
No, of course.
No.
No. You're right. So I said, oh, sure, certainly. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? I covered it up. Because you see, what I'm telling you now, I never told that in public. Yet. I was too guilty. I felt very guilty and ashamed.
Like it was your fault.
I have this childhood and teenage years.
That's pretty common. You thought it was your fault.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
At least partly my fault.
Okay, but we've got you out of high, you graduated high school here, the blind school in Canada. Yeah.
Then all right. Then I'm in Ottawa the next year.
Okay.
In St. Patrick's College. And then I lived in. And there were about 30 guys in there. And there's an incident because... As far as coding is concerned, I took political science, psychology, sociology, but it was all right. You know what I mean? There's nothing to say about that. I was doing all right. You know what I mean?
And so you were in college.
Oh yeah.
And you wanted to. What did you think you wanted to do with?
What I wanted.
Life?
Well, I wanted to become a social worker.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's good.
Which I did eventually. And
yeah.
So there's an incident. You see, there were two of us per room. You see. And one day, you see, I want to tell you something that's funny, I think.
Okay.
In Ontario, you couldn't buy liquor. You couldn't buy booze.
Oh.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
But then, because you needed a permit, you needed to go in certain places, you needed to be a certain age and show certain things. We couldn't do it. So, but across the river from Ottawa, that was Hull, which was in Quebec. And in Quebec, you could do anything you wanted like that.
Yeah.
So... I said to him, I said, let's go and buy a bottle of booze in Hull. So he said, all right. You know, and we did that. And we
so
had,
he had a car, and he took you?
And then some guys came in one day, and they saw us, you know. So he said, hey, I want some. So I said, yeah, okay, we'll give you a glass. But, I mean, you know, we don't want to serve the whole 30 guys now.
Mm-hmm.
So once that guy had left, I said, look to my friend. I said, why don't we buy a few bottles and sell it, you know? So much the shot. He said, well, that's a good. So we did that for about 3 months.
So you were a bootlegger there in college for about 3 or 4 months. Did they catch you?
But then one day something happened. We almost got kicked out. Is that one of the guys, I told my friend, I said, look, that guy, no more. He's got enough tonight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He didn't listen to me. And then we had to go to the chapel with the priest for a ceremony, you see?
Because they wanted to tell you that drinking was a sin and you shouldn't do it, and
Well, they still didn't know at the time. It was a regular thing that we had to attend.
Okay.
While we were in there, that guy that had too much, when he went to kneel, he fell down right on his face in the chapel. So the priest, after the ceremony, they called him up, and he said, what's happening here? He didn't talk. He didn't say anything. So then they got all of us in the big room, and they said, who's done that? Nobody talked. So that ended there.
So now you were the only blind person at this college.
Yes, yes.
Okay, but these kids respected you, and because
we're pretty happy, especially that he was pretty plastered, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
We thought that he might talk, you know what I mean? When you're feeling good, you know?
Oh, I know. I've been there, yeah.
And the next day I saw him, I said, look, he said, you could have tortured me to death. He said,
I would never have told.
Oh, no, yeah. He said, you were nice enough to sell me the stuff, you know what I mean?
But
anyone could have done it, mind you, but no one thought about it.
You didn't get kicked out, and they didn't catch you, and they didn't arrest you or anything.
No,
okay.
But that was the end of it.
And that ended your career as a bootlegger.
Yeah.
All right, how long? Now, you had friends at this college, and
you had a
good time.
Very good friends. When I was there, just a year. The next year, I went to the University of Ottawa, where I spent 3 years.
Okay, so this college, this first year was just a little small college?
More or less. And at the University of Ottawa, for the first time in my life, I took some courses in French. Because, you see, it's a bilingual university. You could take the same course in French or English. And I looked upon the courses, and I took the French one when it suited me for the time it was given. You see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
When I didn't want one in the evening. See, the English one was in the evening, and the French one was in the afternoon.
So you took the French. Yeah. All right. And you did 3 years at the University of Ottawa.
Yeah.
Okay. And got a degree in what?
Oh, I got a degree in psychology and political science minor in history. And Greek art, Greek classics. In minor.
You did all this in 4 years?
Oh, yeah. I took a lot of courses. I mean,
you did?
I even took some summer courses. And in Ottawa, right now in Montreal, it's 82 Fahrenheit. And for us, it's very hot. You know, very, very hot.
Yeah.
And in Ottawa, it gets very hot and very damp and very muggy. And these courses in the summer, you sweat, my friend. You sweat and you sweat and you sweat and you sweat. I still took them. I said, I want to go ahead, you know what I mean? Then when I got my bachelor, I came to Montreal and I went to University of Montreal, where I got my master's degree in social work.
So you went on and got a postgraduate degree in social work.
Yeah.
All right, let's stop right there and take our second little break, and we'll come back and talk about what you're doing now and what you did after you got out of college.
Right.
More of Blind Like Me in just a second.
Gotta say a couple things before you go, even though I know that we're finished. I don't want you to leave without knowing just where I'm coming from, babe.
Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
If you're in the market for any kind of bag, perhaps a new suitcase, a new carrying case for your laptop, a briefcase, a wallet, a duffel bag, a knapsack, then you should take a look at www.ebags.com. They've got quite a selection of different kind of carrying cases. Perhaps you need a case for your cell phone, a case for your CDs. Any kind of carrying case. They have quite a selection at quite a wide price range. I just picked up a new briefcase for my wife. She needed something very light that she could carry around, and I was able to find what I needed. The site is very screen reader friendly. I would give it a screen reader friendly rating of a 9, and you should check it out. www.ebags.com. Until next time, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
Best to love you, baby. I should have placed no one above you. And now it's killing me. Then you know.
We are back with part three. Julian Pelletier is with us, and we've been visiting with him. He's had quite a life, a bad childhood, but ended up at a school for the blind in Canada, then went on to college and got a master's degree in what? Now, your master's is in what?
No, the master's was in social work.
In social work, yeah. So you wanted to help other blind people, that's what you wanted to do?
Yes.
All right, so that was a postgraduate degree. Took how many years? Took 3 years?
No, 2 years.
Took 2 years. So you had 6 years of college.
Yeah, about that.
And we've got you, you were kind of a late starter, so we've got you to almost 30 by now,
pretty
right?
Old. I'm hitting 30, yeah.
We're getting you up close to 30.
I'm getting an old man there.
Yeah. Now, had you lost your sight completely by then?
Pretty well. I just had light perception.
Just light, which is about what
it's
you had.
It's about that time that I met my wife.
Is that right?
She was one of my neighbor's niece. And so I really didn't think that I would marry. You know why? Because my mother gave me a pretty bad idea of what women thought of men. Because my mother always said that women didn't need men.
Well,
I remember at one time when I was about 10 or 12, this girl down the street, you know, she told me, she said, you know, my sister, Pierrette, she's getting married. And I told my mother, I said, you know, Pierrette's getting married. Pierrette was about 18, 19. When you're 12, a girl's 19 is a big, big, big girl, eh? And she said, why would she want to get married? She had a good job. She was a clerk at the bank, you know. And she had a good job. I said, why would she want to get married? She didn't need to bother with a man, you know. So then it got me the idea that women are interested in men only for money.
Your mother gave you this idea.
Yeah. Because I don't think she was very happy with me and with my father. And I don't think she didn't give me the idea that she ever liked men. Because she liked my sister a great deal, you know. And she always gave her the first place. And, you know, one day my sister, when I was 12, she threw me in a pond in a park, you know, near to our place, about a pond that had 7 or 8 feet. I was walking along that. And she came along and she pushed me in there. I almost drowned. I didn't know to swim at the time. And when I came back all wet, my mother said, why did you tease your sister? You know what I mean? Why did you bother her?
It had to be your fault.
Oh, yeah. So I met my wife, and we married, and then I started working.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was very surprised, too, is that two or three people came to the university, and they asked me to go to work for them. So I thought that I'd never find a job in the world. You know what I mean? Even though I had this master's degree, I didn't think I'd find a job that well.
You didn't think you'd be able to find a job even with a master's degree?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Because, you see, I tell you something, Phil. It's because even though strangers or other people tell you you're good, if your parents don't tell you that, it's not the same.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
Because I worked myself with, say, a teenager, let's say 2 years, I mean, he would work with him, and then the parents would disappear, would come back, and they'd say something, a few words, and everything is destroyed almost. It's my dad that says, my mother that says that.
We all have an ego, and all, at certain times, we need that ego stroke. Anybody that says they don't is wrong.
And that ego must be strengthened by our parents.
Yes, it must. It must be.
I remember this guy I placed in a home, the foster home, the best foster home in the world. And one day he left. You know, he left, you know, unauthorized, like, you know.
He ran away. He escaped.
Ran away. Okay. And then I said, look, you got a good home. He said, yes. I said, they're good people. He said, yes. I said, why do you do that? He said, they're not my parents.
They're not my parents. Well, and so you, what do you work for? Do you work for the Commission for the Blind in Canada?
No.
You work for.
First of all, I did my master's thesis with older people. You know, people who lived at home. I wanted to know, why do they live at home? Is it because, you know, why don't they want to go into foster homes? Like, you know what I mean? And I found that it's not because of the money. It's not because they've got a poor home. They only want to go there if they want to relinquish their freedom for security. You see, when a person feels, I need security, I cannot do it anymore on my own, then I'll go there, but I'll have less freedom, but I'll have more security. You see?
In other words, trading freedom for security.
I'm summing up my thesis, my master's thesis.
That's what your thesis was on.
I interviewed 50 people, and it was very, very scientific. I mean, I was checked and rechecked, and I had to rewrite things over and over and over. Yeah, I'm telling you, when I was finished, I was pretty happy.
You interviewed how many people?
50.
50 people?
Yeah.
Now, how did you do that?
I did it with my wife. She wasn't my wife at that time, but we're just...
Oh, and she can see?
Yeah.
Okay.
She can see normally.
She drives the car?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. That's the kind of women I like, the ones that drive cars.
Of course.
Oh, no, I like blind women, too, but, you know.
I remember one day I told my secretary, I said, you know something? You know, I drive the car, and my wife tells me where to turn, this and that.
Yeah.
A few minutes later, I heard her talk to another secretary, and said, you know, Julian can drive. And then I said, I'm going to cut it out right away. I said, look, it's a joke, you know, come on now. I didn't want her to spit it all.
Okay, but you have done that.
Eh?
You have done that. You have driven the car and let your wife tell you which way to go. Because I have, too.
Yeah.
I have, too. I've owned lots of cars and lots of wives. And,
but many,
you know,
lots of wives. Whoa!
Well, I've had three or four or five.
Boy.
I can't remember how many. I'll
never get to your
Well, good. I hope not. But anyway, so you did this.
And you know, but something is true, too, though, Phil. Whenever my wife gets to a place, and she asks me, is it right or right or left that I turn here? I always thought she wanted to make me feel good. But she tells me she really don't know. And
yeah.
I know it's so easy. I find that it's so obvious to me, you see.
You know your way around the city.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So when I started to work, I was an intake for 2 years. All I did was receive the first people, you know, that came without an appointment or that just passed by and they wanted this, they wanted that.
Yeah.
And then I went into, paradoxically, I went into alcoholism and drug addiction. And
okay.
I worked with alcoholics and drug people that had a family. We didn't take people alone, but they were those that had a family. Children and a wife, and we used a great deal the cassette. You know that we used how do you call it? We took pictures, like you know.
Okay, you used the cassettes for what? Now you lost me.
Well, when we had the interviews, we recorded them.
Okay, you record them, and then you instead of making notes, you record them.
Yeah. No, what I mean, I was working with a partner, another girl.
Okay.
And then I forgot the word. I'm pretty nervous, maybe. We used a lot of video.
Okay.
And sometimes we show them back something that we wanted them to know, you know, to understand their behavior.
Yeah.
And for instance, this woman, she had been seeing us for about 4 or 5 times and talking about negatively about her mother.
Negatively about her mother.
And then, but when we showed her back what she was doing, she said, do I ever look like my mother? It's unbelievable.
She was acting just like her mother.
Yeah. So that helped her understand a few things just by seeing that.
That's good.
An example.
Okay, that's good because that happens.
Then I worked with delinquent teenagers for a few years. Then I went to abandoned children. That was pretty hard for me to do because I always felt I was one. You know.
And so it brings back all these memories of what
but,
the places.
Right now,
been.
What I'm doing, I'm working with. Legal adoption and reunion. See, I'm doing some research to find out. Let's say a woman wants to meet with her daughter that she gave up for adoption.
Oh, yeah, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know,
okay.
We find them. I could tell you a thing that I didn't know. Of course, I've been there for 5 years. So. And I want to tell you something that I didn't know, because I didn't know anything about the legal adoption before, is that many Americans came to Montreal to adopt children And so what we have now, when we find a child that's now an adult, he's living in Indiana, in California, in Florida.
Yeah.
I never had one in Texas yet, but in Georgia, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then this guy or this girl comes to Montreal and meets his mother. But the mother doesn't know English many a time. So you have a son and daughter that can't speak to each other too well.
So you got to interpret for it. You got
to
translate
for it. No, I say to them, well, please, one of them will have to try to learn a few words of the other.
Now you are trying to help the parents and not the kids. You're trying to help people who gave up children.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, now do you use the internet as a resource?
Well, we use the internet a lot. We use all sorts of other things. We use the social work international that they call that. Well, there is a movement that is worldwide. You know that they deal especially with children that have been how do you call it? Taken away, like snapped away.
Yeah.
You know, by say a parent that didn't have. That didn't have the legal right to them.
So kidnapped the child and took the child away.
They deal mostly with kidnapping, but they do help us find people.
And so now the kid has grown up, and the other parent wants to,
yes,
to locate the child. Now is this, who do you work for? I mean, what is the?
Well, I work for an agency that is funded 100% by the Quebec government.
Okay.
Right now, this is. Right now, this I work there. Yeah.
So you're a government employee now.
Yes, I'm a public servant.
The public servant. That's better. And this agency that you work for, what is its primary function?
Well, my primary function actually is to research the people and have the reunion right now, because I've done a bit of legal adoption, but now we have no kids. I mean, you know, people want to adopt. Yeah. They have to go to China, they have to go to Mexico, you know, Russia. Because right now, in Montreal, we have about 10 babies a year. And about 25 years ago, they have at least 2,000.
And the government funds this.
Yes.
The government pays. Well, why did Americans come to Montreal to adopt?
Because they didn't find children over there. It was easy. Harder to have them. And over here, we had a lot of them. You see?
And the adoption laws were not as strict up there?
Well, yeah, that's right. The adoption laws were. You see, the adoption laws, it's work state by state and province by province.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it may vary a lot. But the thing is that it was led by Roman Catholics, you see? And you had to pretty well be a Roman Catholic. I mean, if you weren't, it didn't help you. So some people, we know that some Jewish people in New York, they hired Roman Catholic people in New York, go and hire and adopt a child, and then when the child was in New York, then he'd give it back to the Jewish people. See?
Well, you say that there aren't any children to adopt
right now. No.
There aren't homeless children, there aren't...
Well, you see, it's because of the law. The law is made such that, you see, if... there are a lot of homeless children.
Sure there are.
You see, if the parents get in touch with them within 6 months, they're looked upon as not being abandoned.
Okay,
And many a times, they leave them like that. I mean, people know that... That if they see them every 6 months, that they would not be able to be given out to for adoption.
So that's what they do, is just see them every 6 months.
That's pretty bad for the children.
It is.
Because they don't really have parents still.
No, they don't. And they're in foster homes, or they're in what? They're in...
Well, yes, they're foster homes. They may be, if they are more behavioral problems, they're in other places, you know, with the professional people. And,
well, you're old enough to retire. Why haven't you retired?
Well,
why are you still working?
You're right. I tell you, I could have retired a long time ago.
Why are you still working?
Well, I'm not sure. First of all, I think any day, if I spend a day not doing anything, I feel guilty. That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Hey? And I'm afraid that I won't know what to do. That'd be lonesome.
I used to feel that way, but I got over it.
Yeah.
I can sit all day and read a book and never think a damn thing about it.
You know, the girl the other day at work, she said, There's no harm in doing nothing one day.
There isn't any harm in it. Get over it.
You agree with her?
I agree with her. Listen, we got to go. We're out of time. But your story is most interesting. You've done well from coming from where you started. You never would have expected you to do nearly as well as you have. And I admire you, sir.
Yeah.
Hats off to you.
Thanks, Phil.
And thank you, and we'll go. And
coming from you, I appreciate.
Well, hang on just a second, all right?
Okay.
Well, what an interesting fellow he turned out to be, huh? You book a guest, you just never know what their story is going to be like. But his was certainly to be interesting that he was able to come from where he came from and do as well as he did. Obviously, a very, very bright, fellow. And he's talking about coming to Houston. I don't know whether he's going to be able to or not, but He requested all the information and is talking about coming to be with us, and I wish he would, he and his wife. I think it would be interesting to meet him and get him to talk a little bit to us about his experiences and tell us some more about where he's been and things he's done. In case you aren't familiar, and I'll bet you are, with what we're doing in November. Going to do the 100th Blind Handyman Show. We'd like for you to come. We're going to have a live audience. There'll be a lot of us there. And we'd like to have you among our guests. This will be the weekend beginning November 5th on Friday. We will begin on Friday. We will have a good session Saturday. I don't know exactly what we're going to do, but a lot of discussion of blind issues and blind people and a lot of blind people to talk and tell us things about their lives and maybe try to help you with your life, unless it's too late, like it is for me. Anyway, that'll be Saturday night. We'll have karaoke, live music. John Justice is coming, plays piano. I think Malia Dubay is coming. She plays guitar. And several other musician types are scheduled to be there. We don't know exactly, but anyway, I'll be there, John Justice. And that makes two, doesn't it? Two musicians. Anyway, Sunday morning we'll record the blind. Oh, Saturday afternoon we're doing a cooking show. Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, doing a Cooking in the Dark show. Sunday morning, do the Blind Handyman show at 11 o'clock. And then Sunday afternoon, some demonstrations of blind-related products, talking products, and different things of that nature. Sunday night, more karaoke and live music, and we'd like to have you come. You call me, 936-634-9500, or email me, philparr@txucom.net. Hear those numbers one more time, friends. 936-634-9500. That's my home phone number. My email address is philparr@txucom.net. If you're interested in coming, I'd be glad to send you the information. We'd love to have you. The more, the merrier. If we get 10 more people this week, I'll quit talking about it. Okay? 10 more, that's all I ask. We'll see you next week for more The Blind Like Me Show. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.